May it please the Court, Richard Frankel on behalf of appointed amicus curiae in support of appellant Herbert Brown. At issue here is whether Herbert Brown, a pro se plaintiff, has satisfied the minimal notice pleading standards to state a claim that he suffered violations of his Eighth Amendment rights and that appellees, the District of Columbia and the Corrections Corporation of America, knew or should have known of the risk of constitutional violations and failed to act. This Court has repeatedly emphasized that at the pleading stage, a plaintiff need not allege specific detailed facts, but only has to put the defendant on notice of the claims against them. And here, Brown's allegations, although brief at times, do describe the factual basis of his claims. The District Court, however, held, and D.C. now argues on appeal, that because Mr. Brown received some form of medical treatment at some time during the period of his incarceration, he simply cannot state a claim of deliberate indifference to serious medical needs, and that his allegations are legally insufficient to establish a customer policy. The District Court was wrong on both counts. With respect to the first, Brown makes repeated allegations of instances where his care was intentionally delayed or denied, including specifically that a doctor's explicit order for immediate transfer to the D.C. General Hospital for treatment for gallstones was delayed for 60 days, and that states a claim of deliberate indifference, regardless of what other treatment he may have received at different times. And he alleges in several instances that the District of Columbia knew or should have known of the risk of these violations, that they sat idly by while his complaints about his medical needs were ignored, that they failed to curb the known pattern of denied treatment. These allegations establish that the district knew or should have known of these claims and failed to act. I'd like to address the claims against, there are several appellees here, I'd like to address the claims against.
What was the customer policy that was violated here? Even if you've alleged that wrongdoing was directed at Mr. Brown, what's the customer policy under Monell?
The customer policy is that it's one of deliberate indifference, which this Court has recognized as a situation where the district knew or should have known of the risk of constitutional violations and failed to act. And under Warren versus D.C., this Court held that those simple bare allegations of knew or should have known of the risk of constitutional violations but failed to act is sufficient allegation of customer policy. So the idea is that—
Is Warren consistent with Monell?
Yes, Your Honor. Monell says there has to be a customer policy it derives from City of Canton, the later Supreme Court case that established the objective deliberate indifference standard for a customer policy. The idea being that if you complain about mistreatment and the municipality fails to respond, it suggests a practice of tolerating constitutional abuses. And here, where he makes repeated allegations of, there are repeated instances he alleges where he was mistreated, and he alleges specifically that he filed numerous
grievances. Is it sufficient that he shows that he was mistreated, or does he need to show that there was a policy that others would be mistreated as well?
Well, he alleges, I think, to answer your question, I think that he alleges for himself is enough, but he alleges more than that in this case.
Under Warren, it's enough.
Under Warren, it's enough, and under Atchison versus District of Columbia, which this Court held that an allegation of a single instance of misconduct in a failure to train context was sufficient to at least state a claim, because it's possible that's reflective of a broader policy of a failure to act in response to complaints about mistreatment. They said as long as there's a single act, you may be able to have to prove more acts at trial, but the single act is sufficient to raise an inference of customer policy. And here he both alleges not only a single act, he alleges multiple acts by several different doctors over a course of a two-year period, all of which would suggest a widespread practice of tolerating constitutional abuses and failing to respond. He specifically alleges—
Why doesn't it just suggest maybe widespread practice as directed at him? Maybe he was a nuisance. They didn't like him. They thought he was faking this. How does it suggest that there was a policy for the entire system that would get at what Monell's concern?
Well, I mean, if the municipality, I mean, I guess to answer your question in a couple ways, if the municipality had a policy of saying, don't treat him,
right,
that would it's also be a customer policy that would be sufficient to state a claim. And that those allegations are reflective of that. Now, certainly the district is entitled to come back and say, no, these were simply allegations that were directed at him and not reflective of a widespread policy, but that's not the appropriate analysis at a motion to dismiss stage. Here, under a notice pleading standard—
As your point, it doesn't need to be a widespread policy. It just needs to be a policy.
That's right.
A policy directed at one, that's sufficient.
That's right.
Even under Monell.
That's right. And it could also be reflective of more broader treatment.
Right.
Because numerous courts have held that allegations of a municipal failure to respond to the specific events alleged by the plaintiff in that case, without more, can state a custom or policy because they may be reflective of a broader policy that was going before and after. So in that respect, he would state a custom or policy as well.
Why don't you go on to the CCA and the race judicata problem?
Okay. Let me first say, with respect to race judicata, that at most, this would only bar Brown's claims against CCA mm-hmm. for his mistreatment in Ohio. It had no effect on right. his claims against the District of Columbia, which involved an entirely separate set of events. And we think the appropriate analysis here is to remand for the district court to decide this in the first instance.
What is it that we need to know?
Well, you would need to know.
I mean, you make some arguments in your gray brief. Suppose we find them inadequate. I'm thinking specifically of his own suit. You appear to say that the difference is that here Brown added a bunch of other CCA employees, although it's denied that Massey was an employee anyway. It sounds like the same nucleus of operative facts to me.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The reason being that the first in Brown versus CCA, his allegation was solely about a specific instance of treatment by Dr. Mazzi, giving him the improper diabetes medication. Whether or not he should have been diagnosed with hepatitis, alleges a more widespread failure on the part of CCA officials to diagnose him during his entire period of incarceration. And
the claim seems to be he's under the care of a doctor who gets it completely wrong, right? Isn't that a fair summary of the nucleus of operative facts?
That he got something entirely wrong related to whether he had diabetes, not related to whether he had hepatitis. And that hepatitis claim spreads during his entire period of incarceration, which spans possibly as long as 3 years.
The suggestion seems to be that Mazzi keeps on with the diabetes cure on and on and on. Now, unless there's some clear temporal differentiation, which certainly isn't apparent, the period when he's continuously saying it's diabetes erroneously, he must be simultaneously missing the hepatitis, right? What am I missing there?
That the missing of hepatitis, there may be also other doctors who missed, even if it was missed the first time.
What is that? What are other doctors? What does the,
well, that's
the,
why
the,
I think...
The problem is, I mean, broadly, his medical treatment at CCA, but narrowly, it's a problem that is found to be diabetes erroneously and an error which is continuously repeated. Why isn't that a fair statement of the operative facts?
That may be one reading. I think because the record is unclear as to who treated him for how long, there should be appropriate development in the district court to find out exactly how closely related those claims are. This was presented for the first time on appeal by a party that didn't appear below, and Brown has not had a chance to supplement the record with his own filings to determine exactly how closely parallel those claims are or whether they arise out of a different nucleus of operative fact. It may be that they do arise out of the same. We believe that, at least on this reading of the record, it's insufficient to tell whether or not they do. And given that the defendant has the burden of proof on a res judicata defense, it should be appropriately remanded to the district court to decide that in the first instance.
And what about the Boozy case? You argue that the settlement excludes claims arising after October 19, 1998. But if I understand that, the complaint against CCA here, it's, again, an initial failure in which CCA persists, right?
Well,
it can't be that the claim re-arises every day that the CCA doctor fails to get it right?
No, Your Honor, because I think the claim is based on the act, not on what the malady is. For example, if one person alleges that Dr. Mazzi failed to give him an appropriate examination, and as a result didn't uncover an abuse. That's one distinct act of deliberate indifference. And if 2 years later someone else gives him a constitutionally inadequate examination and doesn't uncover the same thing that should have been uncovered in the first place, that's an entirely separate act of deliberate indifference. It arises out of a different nucleus of operative facts, the examination that he was given by this other doctor. They may all result in the same harm, but the critical question is whether the act is the same. And given that those acts are different.
It can't be act. It's got to be nucleus of operative facts, which is surely broader than act. How much broader, I don't know.
That would be the question. But I think in a situation like this, we read the complaint as alleging two different things. There's an allegation on page 16 of the record in paragraph 37 that Dr. Mazzi misdiagnosed him as having diabetes. He decided that he had diabetes and gave him diabetes medication. And then later that he alleges on page 17, paragraph 39, that there was a separate act of failing to diagnose his hepatitis. We think these are separate claims alleging.
Which page?
Page 17, paragraph 39 is the hepatitis allegation. They're separate allegations. It's not clear whether or not they arise out of the same operative facts, and we think that a remand would be appropriate at this stage. With respect to, if the court has questions about, I'd like to briefly turn to Brown's underlying Eighth Amendment claims. We've talked about customer policy, but Brown's allegations establish a claim of violation for Eighth Amendment rights regarding his mistreatment for gallstones, for food poisoning, and for open sores. All three of these, he alleges specific acts where treatment was either intentionally delayed or denied. All of these claims establish.
You've done a job of separating each of these out as if they were separate counts of the complaint, although, of course, they're not actually separated that way in the complaint. Do we need to address them each separately, or is it sufficient if we would agree with respect to any one of these that the case goes back for further developments? It's just a complaint, after all.
That's right. If any one of them he states a claim, it would be appropriate to remand. And
we'd have to, is there some reason to resolve each one of them separately if any one of them is resolvable? I mean, the complaint doesn't actually separate these in the way that perhaps in a fine effort to organize for us, but it's not readily apparent to me that these are necessarily exactly the three, since they seem to change during the briefing as to which three there are.
We would be satisfied if the court remanded the whole case in light of finding that there was a single act of, he stated a claim as to one of those. We have no objection to that. Unless the court has further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mary Wilson, representing the District of Columbia. This is a difficult case for the district, but the district court properly dismissed the case for failure to state an Eighth Amendment claim against the district. The treatment here was not so inhumane as to be repugnant to the conscience of humankind, as the Supreme Court set in Estelle.
Are you talking about the seriousness or the deliberate indifference?
Well,
I thought you had conceded the seriousness.
We conceded the seriousness as to the gallstones.
Yes.
We submit that the deliberate indifference element is missing on the gallstones, that there was insufficient showing of the subjective mental state of deliberate inaction amounting to callousness on the delay in treatment.
You have a prescription of surgery, right?
Yes.
And then nothing happens. Now, I can imagine all kinds of explanations for nothing happening, which would be consistent with good behavior, but we know nothing about those. So we start out with a situation where it looks as if there's a crying need for surgery, and it's delayed for at least 60 days.
The district submits that under Twombly that there just isn't enough.
Yeah, but Erickson seems to indicate that Twombly doesn't apply here.
Well, I think Twombly's clear, even after Erickson, that you have to have a plausible claim. You have to have
right,
something
so
that...
That's fair. So in Twombly, the only facts pleaded were facts about parallel conduct. And since the court had already held that parallel conduct wasn't good enough, that's not good enough. But in this case, he pleads that he had gallstones, I guess, / kidney stones, and that a doctor ordered immediate transfer for surgery, that 60 days later, he had still not been transferred, and he ended up having, I don't know, 15 or 20 of them, of these stones. That seems like enough for a complaint. Why isn't that enough? That doesn't sound anything like Twombly.
Well, Twombly had no facts about an agreement there. And right. Here, the doctor ordered immediate transfer for surgery, and then he wasn't transferred. And there's just no facts about why he wasn't transferred, if there was deliberate indifference, if he was intentionally not transferred.
This is a complaint. I mean, with respect, who is going to know the reason other than the doctor, which you don't – apparently the doctor is not likely to be consulting on the complaint.
Well, there's no – the court is just left to speculate as to any individual.
Yeah, that's why we have summary judgment. That's why we have discovery. That's why we have trials in the end.
We submit
is that
this,
why you say this is a difficult case for the district?
Yes, it's a close case. We admit it's a close case, but the district court, we submit, reached the right conclusion in dismissing the complaint at the 12B6 stage. And the court should reach the same conclusion as to the food poisoning and open sores complaints, that balancing the seriousness of the medical needs there with the nature of the response and the lack of any allegation that there's any continuing repercussion from the lack of treatment, that those conditions, too, did not state an Eighth Amendment.
On the named individual defendants, the ones who were served, my understanding, and plaintiff's counsel, I hope, will correct me if I'm wrong, is that those are named in their official capacity, which, as I understand it, effectively means they don't count. Let's say the money is to come out of the district's pocket. The defendant, the district, is the only real party in interest. Is that your understanding?
Yes. The only individuals who were served were high-ranking officials who
obviously
in their official capacity. The high-ranking officials, a suit against them in their official capacity is a suit against the district in essence, yes.
I actually didn't realize that that was clear. It's clear that they're not the plaintiff is not arguing that they were served in their personal capacity? Is that that?
As to the high-ranking officials, yeah. First of all, they waive any suit against them in their individual capacity.
The plaintiff did?
Where?
Yes. Georgetown has a footnote saying they do not pursue their claim against Williams and the other two high-ranking officials. And I believe the plaintiff adopted that brief.
Okay.
So if there are no other questions, we'll urge the court to affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Eileen Dennis Gilbride on behalf of Corrections Corporation of America. I'd like to first thank the Court for granting my motion to appear here before you this morning. I have 2 points to make for affirmance of CCA's dismissal. The first point is one that Judge Williams made well, and that is that Mr. Brown was a plaintiff in 2 prior lawsuits that covered these exact same issues.
How do you, what's your analysis of the, I guess it's paragraphs 37 and paragraph 39 of the complaint?
I don't see the complaint, Your Honor, as raising any kind of deliberate indifference regarding hepatitis. I agree with Your Honor that it all seems to be one error, one misdiagnosis complaint, that the Dr. Mazzi misdiagnosed his diabetes and gave him the wrong medication for it. The later paragraph simply says that Mr. Brown later found out in a different facility that he had hepatitis. I don't read the allegations at all as saying that CCA knew or should have known that he had hepatitis and deliberately decided not to treat it.
Putting aside that ambiguity, which is an interesting one, Well, 39 clearly introduces something different from 37, right? The question is what it introduces.
Well, it does speak of misdiagnosis. And I think that's the same.
Which happened in 37.
Yes, and then it goes on to say, I found out later that I had hepatitis. But it doesn't say that CCA knew or should have known from what I was saying or what I was complaining or that it knew that I... And then deliberately ignored that. What it was saying is, you people misdiagnosed me and you kept giving me the wrong medication. And when you have a disagreement about how something should be treated, that's A, it's a matter of negligence, if anything. It's not a matter of deliberate indifference.
Yeah, you keep going to what sounds to me like the merits.
Okay.
I'm just trying to figure out whether we have common nucleus of operative facts or not. And
In
37, it appears to be undisputed that a mistaken finding of diabetes is certainly what was involved in the earlier suit.
Yes.
The question is whether a new nucleus of operative facts is introduced in paragraph 39.
Are you talking about new as opposed to the Brown lawsuit, the first lawsuit then?
Yes.
I think it's the exact same claim, and he speaks of misdiagnosis, and that's exactly what he was talking about in Brown. Another point to raise is even if it is a separate, a part of the misdiagnosis, not only did you misdiagnose my diabetes, but you should have diagnosed something else. That is the same common nucleus of operative fact as the Brown case, and not only that, it is covered by the release in the Busey settlement, because Mr. Brown alleged that all of this occurred in 1997 when he was transferred to the CCA facility, and that it kept occurring. It was the same thing that occurred all the way through. And the Busey settlement covers everything that occurred before October of 1998. So even if it's not the same, I think it is the same nucleus of operative fact. If you can even argue that it was a different claim, I think it's the same misdiagnosis claim, which is a negligence claim, A. But B, it was covered by the Brown complaint, which also speaks of misdiagnosis. And C, it's covered by the Busey release, which covers everything that occurred before 1998. So I had 2 points to raise for affirmance of the dismissal, and now I've covered about 3 of them. Because it is all wound up into the same thing. It's covered by res judicata because it's something that was or could have been raised in the Brown lawsuit. It was released. It was raised and released in the Busey lawsuit, and it's also insufficient to state a claim under the Eighth Amendment because, if anything, it raises a misdiagnosis, which at most is negligence and not a deliberate indifference.
So wouldn't it have been good if you had raised these claims in the district court?
It would have been great if we had raised them in the district court, Your Honor, and unfortunately, I have no answer for why CCA's general counsel didn't have knowledge of this lawsuit. It appeared to have been properly served on the facility, the Northeast Ohio facility, by certified mail. General counsel's office did not know of it until Amicus sent their brief to the counsel in our office who represents CCA. That was here in this court. That's the first notice that we had of this lawsuit. Practically, I understand that there was there appears to have been proper service. However, the court, as the court knows, it can decide and it can consider res judicata for the first time on appeal. And the purpose for this...
Has this happened before?
It's never happened before, to our knowledge. No, I guess things fall through the cracks, and that's about the best I can say about it. But the only last point I would make with my 41 seconds is that there's really no reason to address the Monell issue because this just isn't the right case for it. It should be addressed in a case that raises the issue properly, that isn't barred by res judicata release and failure to state a claim, unless the court has other questions. Thank you for your time.
Let me just first point out, with respect to whether the individual defendants were sued in their individual or personal capacities, on page 7 of the joint appendix in the complaint, Brown says that all of the above defendants are being sued in their individual capacities. So he is bringing, he is not waiving any claims for damages against them.
Well, in that case, where in the complaint is there anything alleged about their personal participation, personal knowledge, anything else?
Your Honor, we, as Ms. Wilson correctly noted, we did not raise that. Brown, I just want to point out, though, that Brown did file a separate brief in which he did raise that claim. And he does allege, he specifically mentions on page 10 of his brief, Anthony Williams, Odie Washington, and Elwood York. So he is preserving that claim for appeal. With respect to, I'd like to briefly address the claim about whether it's possible to infer deliberate indifference from the failure to follow Dr. Rafford's orders. Several courts have found, whether for purposes of motion to dismiss or for summary judgment, that deliberate indifference can be inferred from the delay itself. We cite a case of Skakluna versus Wells from the Sixth Circuit, which said that in the absence of any explanation for the delay, a reasonable inference arises that the defendant purposely ignored the emergency treatment report specifying that the plaintiff required an immediate neurological consult. So you can infer from the fact of the delay for the purposes of motion to dismiss that there was deliberate indifference.
With respect to the CCA claim, in paragraph 37, it certainly sounds like a malpractice claim, doesn't it? I mean, it's Dr. Mazzi who misdiagnosed the plaintiff and gave him improper medication. That sounds like a malpractice claim, not like a deliberate indifference claim.
Right. Our claim is that it's not simply that he misdiagnosed him, but that after Brown complained that the medication was causing him pain,
yes,
he refused to change the course of treatment.
And where is that alleged?
That is alleged on paragraph 47, the second paragraph 47 there, too. It's on page 20 of the appendix. He says that the denial, he talks about Dr. Mazzi at the beginning and says, this denial.
I'm sorry, hold on just for one second. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm getting lost. Paragraph 47 of the complaint?
Yes, it's the second paragraph 47. There's a very short paragraph 47, and then there's one that goes from page 19 to 20.
All right, and where is Dr. Mazzi mentioned? I'm sorry.
He says, plaintiff's rights were violated by the denial of adequate medical care by their staff doctor, Dr. Mazzi, Mr. Mazzi, and that he then says later down about the fifth line, this denial was brought to their attention through grievance procedure and several pleas for assistance. The above defendants instead allowed the above-named medical staff member to inflict wanton and unnecessary infliction of physical and mental pain on this plaintiff out of deliberate indifference to his medical needs. And
so that actually has to do with the other defendants, not Dr. Mazzi.
I think it's a fair inference that when he complained about that Dr. Mazzi would be informed, or that Dr. Mazzi would have complained to Dr. Mazzi first and then gone to them.
I think it's the case that you don't have to plead too many facts, but when you do plead some facts, as in Twombly, that seem inconsistent with the requirements of the law, you can be stuck with those. We certainly said that before. A person can plead themselves out of court. So with respect to Mazzi, he pleads what sounds like a simple case of malpractice, but where does he say that Mazzi withheld treatment afterwards, or something you were just saying?
He says that they instead allowed Mazzi to inflict unnecessary and wanton and unnecessary infliction of physical pain
by the continued treatment
of the medication.
But given the previous quite specific factual complaints about Mazzi, it sounds like what they mean is he misdiagnosed, and as a consequence, there was serious pain. But where is the idea that he did something other than maybe make a very bad judgment with respect to the diagnosis?
I think the allegation is that once he informed CCA officials that the medication was causing him pain, then any failure to respond to that complaint and the continued practice of giving him medication that he knew was causing him pain, that states a claim of deliberate indifference. And that's the Greeno versus Daly case that we cite in our brief. In addition to that, on paragraph 44 of the complaint, which I believe is on page 18, he alleges not only a paragraph 45, which is on page 19 of the appendix, he alleges both a misdiagnosis and a failure to examine at all. It says Mazzi for his failure to examine and diagnose plaintiff. And fairly read, the failure to even give him an examination could state a claim.
Fair enough, but I'm reading it the most direct way I can. For his failure to examine before prescribing medication, that sounds like malpractice. You don't give medication before you examine somebody. But that It's not he failed to respond, he failed to see the person or anything like that. He did give them medication according to this allegation.
Well, I think it could be read in two ways. One, he negligently gave him the wrong medication, or he intentionally refused to give him a proper examination, didn't bother to consider what his condition could be, and then just gave him some medication. That intentional failure to refusal to examine would be a claim.
Where's the intentional part?
Well, it's failure to examine. I think it's a fair inference that that could be a reckless or intentional.
Mr. Frankel, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Brown in this not to represent, but to be amicus for us in this case. And the court thanks you for your assistance.
Thank you.